ओम ब्रह्म सत्यम शिवम सुंदरम नैनं छिन्दन्ति शस्त्राणि नैनं दहति पावक न चैनं क्लेदयं ताप न शोषयति मारुत। द स्पिरिट इन मैन इज इम्पेरिशेबल एंड इंडिस्ट्रक्टिबल। वेपन्स कैनॉट क्लीव इट, फायर कैनॉट बर्न इट, water cannot drench it, nor can wind make it dry. I shall read a few lines about meditation from here, the rhythm of truth. Meditation is the art of self-unfolding, a psychological reorientation. It is the means of discovering the unique rhythm of one's being. In accord with one's own peculiar talent, it is progressive development. Meditation is gathering the power of silence. When silence settles in the mind, perfect peace holds sway. When the heart is filled with love, all doubts are cast away. Then is set the stage for the play of divine grace. I am going to speak this morning on mysticism of the Kabbalah. You know, we are going nowadays through a lot of very radical changes in our ways of thinking, in our outlook, in our collective consciousness. And one of the changes is a definite shift of interest from theology to mysticism. So long and so much religion has centered around theological dogmas, on creeds, on faith. People have been exposed too much to that, the dogmatic approach and the emphasis upon the creedal essence of religion. But now it seems people, all spiritual seekers, young and old, are hungry for experience, for some kind of personal communion with the divine, some kind of direct approach to ultimate reality or to awareness of the higher self of man, of the individual. So this is the essence of the shift of interest from theology to mysticism, whereas theology, religion, traditional religion, is based upon faith. Mysticism says that it is possible for man to go further and to go beyond faith and to be able to transform faith or belief into personal experience, personal realization of the Supreme Truth in some measure. That is part of the spiritual potential of man. In other words, here mysticism is laying stress upon actually the flowering, the full flowering, the possibility of full flowering of human individuality, instead of the individual relying upon an organized religious apparatus for his salvation. Emphasis in mysticism is that it is possible for the human individual, as a child of God, as a child of the infinite, to approach direct to God and have to have some kind of contact. This is the very birthright of the human individual as a human being and therefore as a spiritual being. Another reason why it is good that there is this shift of interest from theology and from traditional religion to mysticism is that there is this element of universality in mysticism. When I say mysticism, I mean authentic mysticism, not some kind of mystery mongering, not that. Not the kind of mysticism which is sometimes practiced by secretive groups, not that. But authentic mysticism, the essence of which lies in man's personal realization of the truth, ontological experience of ultimate reality. See, this is the very heart of mysticism. So what I was going to say, that another important thing in mysticism is the element of universality in it. Mystics, foremost mystics the world over, seem to speak the same language, a very similar language. And so they have a way of understanding each other and communicating with each other very quickly and very promptly and very directly. So this is wonderful. This is very good. That is why it is good today to have some understanding and also to practice in life something along this line, so that one can eventually attain some kind of personal realization of God or the Absolute or the Cosmic Self. There may be slight variations, but when we study the mystical trends in world thought, we find that in the writings, in the sayings, in the experiences of the foremost mystics of the world, there is some common denominator. There are certain elements of universal value and significance which we can easily recognize. It is only natural that within the framework of this universal spiritual outlook and orientation, there will be some minor variations as a result of people living in different cultural conditions, in different socio-political conditions, so on and so forth. So it is with that in view that I am going to discuss today briefly some of the essential tenets of the mysticism of the Kabbalah. This book here is very good, Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism by Sholem is a good book. You know, there are all kinds of books available in the market, but not all are too authentic or too reliable. But I think this is a very excellent book which gives an account of the important trends in Jewish mysticism, well documented, well authenticated. Now, mysticism of the Kabbalah, within Kabbalah, actually, there are two types of mysticism. One is prophetic mysticism, and another is theosophic mysticism. One is prophetic or ecstatic mysticism, and another is theosophical mysticism. And I'm going to discuss today mainly the ecstatic prophetic mysticism of the Kabbalah. It flourished in France, and especially in southern France, and especially in Spain, the golden age of this ecstatic prophetic mysticism flourished in Spain from 1200 to early 14th century. Now, according to our practice here, what I always do is try to single out and to concentrate those elements of ancient, medieval, religious, philosophical, mystical traditions which are of significance and value even today for modern man. So this is what I am going to do too, just concentrating on the elements of universal significance and modern or contemporary relevance, without going too much into detail or into historical background, or without bringing up things which might not be too relevant today. At the very beginning, I would like to mention one thing. I said that there is an element of universality in mysticism, but there are minor variations. Two outstanding characteristics of Jewish mysticism are these. First, which all mystics, all authentic mystics, aspire for and eventually attain in some measure personal contact with ultimate reality. You see, this is the very heart of mysticism. A mystic believes that as a child of God, he can directly approach God and enter into some kind of blissful, loving communion with the Supreme Being. He does not have to go through an intermediary. He does not have to go, you see, make a detour, and because he has this divine right to approach directly. So this concept of direct union with ultimate reality is the very core of the mystical outlook. Now this direct contact, union, communion, however you will find when you study comparative mysticism, has assumed many forms, many interesting, many fascinating forms. In my Tuesday class I had been discussing some of these different forms of mystical union with the divine. Now a distinctive characteristic of the Jewish approach, Jewish mysticism, is that it does not believe in absolute absorption in the absolute. It's complete absorption, self-loss, self-annihilation in the absolute. You see, in some ideal of union with God, this has been stressed, that in pursuing union with God, eventually the individual undergoes self-annihilation, is completely absorbed in the universal substance of God. Now, in Jewish mysticism, they always retain or maintain a sense of distance. Union plus distance. You see, there is union, but still there is a sense of distance. There is identification with the Absolute, the feeling of union and identification, but without annihilation. So this is one of the characteristics. At the very beginning, I wish to make this, you know, bring this out. It will be good for you to have this general idea. So this is how I can put it. The characteristic Jewish ideal of Jewish mysticism is union and identification with reality, with the divine, without annihilation, maintaining a sense of distance. Another characteristic element, general characteristic element of Jewish mysticism is that it emphasizes prophetic ecstasy. So there is an element of prophetic vision in mystic experience. So you hear about the Jewish prophets. I should like to discuss a little. What is the exact meaning of this word prophet? Not all people have the right and adequate idea of prophet. So this is another characteristic, the element of prophetic vision in mystical realization. And I shall be discussing presently what that prophetic vision is. But at the beginning, suffice it to say that prophetic vision, prophetic experience means that as the mystic enters into communion with the divine, he has a sense of obligation to God to do something. You see, he has the feeling of being an agent, an instrument of the divine, doing something for the glory of God in life, in the world, or an endeavor to change the outside world for the glory of God. You see, this is the prophetic element here. All right. So with this introduction, let me now proceed to bring out a few things about the ecstatic mysticism of the Kabbalah. The central figure here is Abraham Abulafia, who was a great mystic and also a great writer. And who was also influenced a good deal by Oriental, by Eastern mysticism. He traveled a good deal, and he went to the East, and he associated with or encountered many Muslim mystics, many Hindu mystics. As a matter of fact, on account of these wide experiences and wide travels, he developed some kind of Jewish yoga. See, some kind of Jewish yoga, right? The author has mentioned that, you see, some of the things he emphasized and some of the elements he brought out are very similar to the concepts and the practices of yoga. So I shall tell you in what respects it is. But the writings of Abraham Abu Lafia are the basis of this prophetic, ecstatic Jewish mysticism of the Kabbalah. First, as a good mystic and as an authentic mystic, he points out that mysticism should not be confused with visionary experiences. Very often, so often that happens. You see, people, as they trade the spiritual path, pretty soon they may, or as they fast and observe different religious ceremonies, then they may go through different kinds of visual psychic experiences. Seeing visions, hearing voices, having feelings of grandeur or feelings of power, all these things, these visionary experiences. So as a good, authentic mystic, he warns against that, that these are temptations of the devil. You see, having these feelings of grandeur and power, trying to do all kinds of things in order to, you know, make a display. See, these are all temptations of the devil. And so an authentic spiritual seeker must be very careful about this. He must not pay too much attention to all these wayside experiences of the spiritual path. He must go straight, ignoring these wayside experiences. Otherwise, he will be stopped short. He will go astray. So, in India, we say that when a yogi pays too much attention to these visionary experiences and begins to make a display of his yogic powers, then he goes astray. He is called a bhrashta yogi, a yogi who has gone astray, who has not been able to, you know, pass, tread the path and go right up to the spiritual destiny. And so along the same line, Abu Lafia sounds this warning that one should carefully distinguish mysticism from magic. So often that confusion takes place. People come to mysticism, practice mystical exercises, go through different, you know, spiritual exercises, develop some power, and then they want to use that power for self-aggrandizement, to impress others. It's kind of magic, using supernatural power for natural motivations, with natural motivations. This is magic. And Abu Lafia points out that magic, even though it may not be black magic, even though it may be white magic, see, white magic means, you see, black magic is you are practicing magic in order to injure other people, in order to dominate, in order to hurt the interests of others. That is black magic. White magic is that you are not trying to injure, but you are trying to glorify yourself, impress others. So magic, whether black or white, is falsification of true mysticism, which is a very important truth, and we should all take heed of this warning, that magic, white or black, is falsification of true mysticism. Because as I pointed out at the very beginning, the ultimate goal of mysticism is immediate, blissful, loving communion or contact or union with the divine. That is the very core of mysticism. Then he says, you know, laying aside white magic and black magic, then he says that if you want to use the word magic at all, then only magic that mysticism has used for is the magic of inwardness, magic of the spirit, magic of truth and love. You see, magic of inwardness, looking within yourself and discovering God within. And the technique of this looking within, this magic of inwardness, is what is called meditation. See, because it is there, in the shrine of shrines of your own heart, that you will discover the truth that will save you. You will discover the indwelling light of God. See, this meditation. So at this point, I would like to tell you a very well-known story, which brings out the importance of this looking within, finding truth or God within yourself, at your own home. There was a very pious rabbi who used to live in Krakow, the capital of Poland, and he was very poor, but a very religious man. His name was Rabbi Isaac, son of Rabbi Jekyll. It was with great difficulty that he used to keep his body and soul together. In other words, you see, a very religious man that he was, he had no time to pay attention to the mundane things, and consequently, he lived in poverty. One day he had a dream, and the dream told him to undertake a long journey and to go to the Bohemian kingdom, and there, underneath the main principal bridge of the Bohemian kingdom leading up to the palace of the king, underneath the bridge was buried a rich treasure. So he should go there and dig it out, and that will solve all his problems. Next day, see, he just remembered the dream, but he brushed it aside. That's a silly dream, wishful thinking. Next day, the dream was repeated. Next day, again, the same dream came. So that after this, he could not ignore it anymore. He girded up his loins and was ready to undertake the journey. Traveling long, he came to the Bohemian kingdom, and verily indeed, there was a magnificent bridge there leading up to the palace of the king. But to his great dismay, he found that the bridge was being guarded day and night by sentries. And the captain of the sentries was a fierce looking man with big moustache. Who dares go there? So every day he would come there. All that he could do, he used to come and loiter around and from a distance watching the masonry and the soil and this and that. So that is every day, for a few days he was doing that. Now the captain of the sentries, for all his fierce looking moustache, you see, he had some sympathy for this man. He began to wonder, what is he doing here? Every morning he comes, he loiters around. Has he lost something? Or is he waiting for some friend? So he felt kind of curious. So he came to this man, and with some sympathy in his tone, he asked, inquired, what are you doing here? And a very simple, pious man that he was, he frankly told him the whole story, how he saw the dream and how he expected a treasure in the. On hearing this, he laughed. You are a silly man. You have worn out your shoes, coming all the distance, loitering here day after day, trusting a dream, and laughed again. Then he says, let me tell you my story. He says, just the other day I saw a dream, and my dream told me that I should go to Krakow, the capital of Poland, and find out the house of a man called Rabbi Isaac, son of Rabbi Jekyll. And the dream told me that in the humble cottage of this man, in his kitchen, just behind his stove. There was a rich treasure hidden. He said, had I been a fool like you, trusting a dream, just this moment I would have been in Krakow hunting for this, you see, going through the ghetto and searching for the house of a man called Rabbi Jekyll. And just imagine, half the people there are called Jekylls and half the people there are called Isaacs. And he laughed again. And he was just patiently and humbly hearing. And without saying a word, he parted company and hurried back home. And began to dig in the dirty corner behind his stove. And verily indeed was buried there wonderful treasure which he found. And with a and the treasure certainly solved his problems. Not only that, with a portion of that treasure he built a temple of the spirit which stands even today bearing his name. So that's the story. That's the story of man's inward look. Truth is right there at his own home. You see, the stove is the heat and warmth giving center of the kitchen, of your home. Eh? Heat and warmth giving center, that is your heart. Stove is the symbol of your heart. Heat, warmth, love giving center. Dig for truth, for the treasure. Treasure that will solve all your problems. Right there, behind your stove, behind your heart center. This is called in Hindu yoga, this is called Hrit Padma, the heart center. That's all. Heart center. The center of divine love and divine truth. You see? Digging right there in your heart center, you will discover the most wonderful treasure that you can, beyond all your dreams. So, this is the point of emphasis in all mysticism. You see, Jewish or Christian or Sufi or Buddhist or Hindu, all mysticism. Look within, right at your own home, right at the center of the structure of your own existence, in your own heart, in the inmost recess of your own heart, you will find the most wonderful treasure of your life. And then he develops certain principles. You know, I shall tell you briefly some of the things which again will remind you of yoga techniques. Because he says that in order to do this digging in your own heart center, you should have a quiet house, a quiet room. A quiet room which is dedicated to this purpose. Then it should be properly decorated with flowers and greens to create a pleasant atmosphere. The flowers and greens and all that. Then, as he puts it, that this will please and stimulate pleasantly the vegetable aspect of our soul. We have some oneness with the vegetable kingdom. You see. Then he says that either there can be soft, nice, inspiring music in the room, or you read in a rhythmical way, in a singing voice from a scripture or do some chanting which will please and stimulate the animal part of the soul. You see, pleasant sound. All right. Then he says breathing. Good breathing is very important. Right breathing is very important. And as you all know that in the system of yoga which developed in India has gone very profoundly, deeply into the art of breathing. All kinds of breathing exercises. Not all people need to go or practice complicated breathing exercises, but some simple, good breathing exercise can prove excellent for anybody, for everybody. Because there is very close connection between right breathing and right thinking. You see, right breathing and proper functioning of the mind. So art of breathing is a very important component, ingredient of yoga practice, and he emphasizes that, the art of breathing. And then he says, this is something very interesting too, he says that there are, of course, as I have discussed in my book, Philosophy of Meditation, there are different methods and techniques of meditation. Different people find it, find different methods helpful to them. You see, there are some, for example, who have a training in concentration by looking at, by contemplating the beauty of a flower, let me say, a flame or a flower, or anything else which is very lovely, which appeals to you, which is beautiful. Point of emphasis in ecstatic, in Kabbalah mysticism is that instead of doing this, he felt, you see, Abu Lafia felt, that sometimes people, even though the instruction in yoga is that you train your concentration by contemplating something lovely, something beautiful, and then you direct your concentrated mind to God. This is it. But many people eventually don't get around doing that, you see. They contemplate something beautiful and they just stayed there. Their mind is so much fascinated by the beauty of the thing they are contemplating that eventually they cannot turn it up to God. So in order to prevent that, he says that what one can do is to take up something which has no intrinsic beauty of its own, but which directs your mind to God. You know, something which does not capture your attention by itself, by its own beauty or attractiveness, but which has the power of stimulating mind to God. So that is the art, technique which he has emphasized. What is that? What can it be? Something which has no attractiveness of its own, but which can stimulate your mind to God. He says, that is the name of God. You see, just the name of God, a combination of the letters, combination of letters, a set of words, just as we say mantram, You see, it's the name of God. So you concentrate on that. And one practice he has advocated is that right in your, this is, we call it Ajna Chakra, Ajna Chakra, center between the eyebrows. So he also recommended that. He says that you can visualize, if you are, for example, Hebrew, if Hebrew is your language, then you can visualize the name of God, letters, Hebrew letters of Jehovah, Hebrew letters of God, and concentrate on the letters, on the name of God, visualizing that here. And that can be a wonderful experience, he says. And in connection with that, he also recommends the practice, the technique of combination and permutation of the different letters of the alphabet. So that is another technique he has advocated. The combining and recombining and permuting the different letters. And if we do that with concentration, fixing our mind on God, on the name of God, then some wonderful things can come out of this practice, this technique of combination and permutation. All that. So then step by step, this is good. This is called Jewish yoga because that is here a systematic procedure step by step, you know, doing all these things. I began with sitting quietly, relaxed in a quiet room, and then I have mentioned about flowers and greens, I have mentioned about breathing, I have mentioned about concentration. Then he says effacement, that is another stage in the practice of meditation. Search for the truth or God within yourself. Effacement. You see, this corresponds to what we call in yoga pratyahara. What is our issue today? I don't see it. It is called pratyahara. You see, effacement. Thank you. You see, in Indian yoga, there is much emphasis upon pratyahara. Pratyahara means withdrawal of the mind. You see, in order that you can focus your mind with all your being, with all your psychic energy upon the higher self or God, you must be in a position, must be able to completely withdraw your mind from everything else. You see, this is the great power of the mind. You have to train your mind to do this. This is called pratyahara, and this is what he has called effacement, effacing everything else from your mind. Or the power of abstraction, abstracting your mind from everything else. You see, effacement, abstraction, pratyahara. You see, so one after another, you have to abstract your mind from everything that is not God. You see, first of all, from natural images and forms, visuals, sensual forms, images. Abstract your mind from that. Then comes, as you close your mind, you have abstracted your mind, withdrawn your mind from natural, sensuous forms, images, objects. Then come different ideas in your mind, or different visions, psychic images. For some time you go through this, you have different fantasies. For some time you may go through this, but then abstract your mind, withdraw your mind. In order to facilitate this withdrawal and abstraction from all these different things, you see, in Indian yoga, the recommendation is that you observe and let go, offer to the divine. That is a wonderful way of abstracting, effacing. You see, this is a good practice. So whatever comes into your mind, you observe and you let go, offer to the divine. Let God take care of it. You see, because this is in this way, you are effacing, pratyahara. All right. Then you are rising above all images, visions, psychic experiences. Then there may come some very abstract ideas in your mind, concepts, conceptual truths. So in that connection he mentions about the help that science, that mathematics, the dialectics can offer. Because in that way we train and develop our intellectual power and have some intellectual, very abstract and profound intellectual concepts of God and ultimate reality. Now, a mystic will warn you that even that is not your ultimate goal. Because even now, you are still in the realm of ideas and concepts. You have not made immediate contact with reality. So eventually you have to efface this also. You have to abstract from that, withdraw from that also. You must transcend the farthest boundaries of the realm of ideas and concepts and notions and categories. See. Then what happens? What happens is, suddenly, something very strange may happen to you. Suddenly your whole being may be seized with fear and trembling. You may feel that you are going to die. You see, this is a danger point now. You see, when you have abstracted to this point, then suddenly this fear comes into your mind. Your whole being is seized with a kind of trembling. And you may have a fear that you are going to die. This is where the assurance of the guru is very necessary. Faith in the guru, the teacher, you see, is very important. You have to keep alive your flame of faith. Must not succumb to this fear. You see, the reason of this fear is that you have now come to the farthest boundary of the familiar. And you can now see that beyond this is the unfamiliar, the unknown, the unseen. Naturally, therefore, your mind is seized with a very strange fear and trembling. When there is fear, there is trembling. But you have to overcome this. Now you have to remember the reassuring words of the great masters of the world, that beyond the familiar is the wonderful realm of the unfamiliar, the unseen and the unknown. If you have faith and you make this leap beyond the conceptual, step forth into the transcendental, that is the realm of love and bliss and beatitude. But you have to overcome this fear, and the faith in God, in the Guru, helps you to overcome that fear. Because he says that when you have this experience of fear and trembling, actually that is the great moment for you, that is the boundary line between the seen and the unseen. between the relative and the absolute, between the empirical and the transcendental, is the boundary line. You are now going to cross the boundary line. So you have fear. But once you cross, all fear and anxiety melt away. All doubts are dissolved. Then after that, what? As you overcome the fear, you see, then there is an expression used, and that is self-confrontation. You know, there are so many similar words. Self-realization, self-awareness, self-actualization, so many. Self-discovery. But the word used here in Kabbalah is self-confrontation. What is that? Self-confrontation. Now, you remember I say that in Jewish mysticism there is always this experience, a feeling of a little distance. Suddenly, as you come to this borderline, you see your own self standing over against you, confronting you. So that is why they use confrontation. The word confrontation is used. Suddenly you see, standing before you, your own true self. Some say that it is your own true self. Some say that this is God. God as Shaddai. God as Shaddai. Some say that this is that which stands confronting you, is the representative God, is the angel Metatron. Metatron, the angel Metatron, which is the Hebrew word for master. It's the Hebrew word for master. So the divine as the master. So this is the experience now. At this borderline, you suddenly, as you have overcome your fear, you have the experience of confronting, standing face to face with a great reality, spiritual reality, by whatever name you call it. You may call it your own true self. You see, you may call it Metatron, the master. You may call it God as Shaddai. In Hindu philosophy, they call it Shiva, the great guru, divine guru, Lord Shiva, S-H-I-V-A, Shiva, the divine guru, guru that dwells in the heart of each one of us. You see? So you have this experience of confrontation with the divine element within you, the divine guru within you. And that is a very profoundly blessed moment of spiritual realization. You see, this confrontation itself. Then finally, when you do confront this is another point of emphasis in prophetic mysticism, you see, prophetic Kabbalah. You hear the command of the divine power. Who charges you with a mission. This is prophetic mysticism. Who charges you with a mission. This is what you have to do for the glory of God. These are the changes you have to try to bring about in the external world for the manifestation of the divine kingdom. You see, this is the prophetic element here. You see, the dynamic element here. You see, this is also the element which in modern times Sri Aurobindo has very much emphasized. This dynamic mysticism, you see, not simply attaining salvation, not simply being absorbed in the universal substance of God, but functioning dynamically, creatively, as the channel of expression of the divine glory. You see. So this is how they have put it, that when you have this experience of confrontation with the divine power, then you just patiently, humbly wait to hear the command of God, you see, command of the higher spirit. Because you have a mission to accomplish in life. Once you hear that voice, the authentic voice of God within you, then that is it. That is your ultimate destiny. That is the ultimate meaning of your life. There is no more any room for any shadow of doubt regarding that. After that, there can be only absolute concentration of your energy on the fulfillment of this divine command. You know, those of you who are familiar with Indian yoga would remember that this is called Ajna, A-J-N-A, Ajna, command. When there is the full opening of the center, eyebrow center, then you hear the command. You see, this is according to, you know, Hindu yoga system. And as soon as you hear that command, you see, you can no longer rest content passively with your own personal salvation. Your whole being is transformed into a dynamic personality. You are now eager to function and act with all your being and with all the love in your heart to do something, to produce changes in your surroundings and in human relations, to establish the kingdom of love and truth, or for the glory of God. And that becomes now one overmastering impulse of your life, one overmastering passion, if I may say so, overmastering passion of your life. And when one attains this goal on this stage, he is the true prophet. You know, I said that this is prophetic mysticism. When one has this experience, going through the different phases of meditation, finally has this experience of confrontation with God as Shaddai, or as Metatron, the Master, or as the Higher Self, and hears the command of God, Ajna, and is now ready to act with one's whole being and love for the glory of God, then he is the true prophet. And a true prophet, therefore, is the culmination of this whole meditative process of spiritual growth and fulfillment. This prophet, therefore, the prophet idea is distinguished from a scholar. You know, there are different phases, as he says. First of all, there is a scholar. It's a person who has read different books and who has a lot of book learning knowledge. He's a scholar, he's a pandit. He can quote chapter and verse from all the scriptures, but then he may not have experience of his own. You see, so in India we say that he is like a donkey. You know? A donkey carries heavy bag of sugar, you know, on his head. Heavy bag of sugar he's carrying, he's willing to carry, and he carries with pleasure that bag, but he has no taste of that sugar. So a man whose whole knowledge is just book learning is like that. This is how, you know, they put it in India. Then there is, he's the hakam, you know, hakam, the scholar. Then there is the spiritual scholar, you know, spiritually oriented scholar. You see, who has received his knowledge from another person who is enlightened. So he is called Mevi. Then there is one who has developed his knowledge not simply externally from books and hearing, but his own contemplation and reflection upon his experiences and observations. You see? So. When that happens, then he is called a Gnostic, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, Gnostic. Daton, D-A-A-T-A-N, Daton, Daton, the Gnostic. Because he has developed his knowledge from his own contemplation and reflection upon his experiences and observations of the nature of things and the ways of life. After that is the prophet. This is the prophet, therefore, is distinguished from Hakam, Mevin, Daton. Prophet is one who has attained, you know, this is the Hebrew word which is used, who has attained devekut, D-V-K-U-T-H, devekut, being with God. That is devekut. Being with God. So as a result of this attainment, of this exalted condition of being with God, you see, he attains profound peace and illumination, genuine wisdom, illumination, and at the same time, a creative personality, a willingness to act and to dedicate his life completely to the fulfillment of the divine will in life and society. Thank you. Now Shasta will play piano, and a love offering will be taken.